The following episode of the 9 p.m. Edict contains strong language. You bet you do. You bet it does. Shirt front.
Wednesday, the 22nd of October, 2014. Australia's former Prime Minister Gough Whitlam is dead.
In every sense, Gough Whitlam was a giant figure in this Parliament and in our public life.
Politicians across the political spectrum praise Whitlam as a man of vision. But how does the current mob stand up?
He's an economic girly man. He doesn't have what it takes to repair the budget mess.
And yesterday was International Fisting Day. What did you do to celebrate? This is the 9 p.m. Vision for Australia.
The national leader of the Australian Labor Party, Mr. Gough Whitlam.
Men and women of Australia, this isn't the latest chart topper from Taylor Swift you're listening to now, though you could be forgiven that. This is the applause for Gough Whitlam at the Labor Party's policy launch on the 13th of November 1972 at the Blacktown Civic Centre in Sydney. 3 weeks later, Whitlam became Australia's first Labor Prime Minister in 174 years. He introduced universal health care, free university education, paved roads, an end to the Napoleonic Wars, the steam engine, algebra, lowercase letters, aqueducts, animals with backbones, the so-called vertebrates, the lever and the inclined plane, an atmosphere with oxygen. Yeah, look, this isn't a fanboy tribute to Whitlam, even though he was obviously a very important political figure. Why? Because A, there's been enough tributes over the past 36 hours, and B, I'm not a fan. I mean, I'm not really a fan of anyone or anything. That mindless irrationality that sits at the core of fandom, I mean, that's what the word is, right? Fanaticism. That simply doesn't appeal to me. And anyway, I was a mere child in the Whitlam era. I knew nothing of politics. I mean, who was Whitlam? Did he ever land an Apollo spacecraft on the moon? No. So who cares, right? And anyway, let's be real, in the current climate, if you identify as a fanatic, you're likely to find yourself on the receiving end of an FA-18 strike. So it's best to be a little more measured in one's thoughts. That said, the death of Gough Whitlam provides a unifying context to some of the things I wanted to say this episode. And I did actually meet him once. In fact, why not? Let's kick off with that story. It was at ABC Radio in Adelaide, South Australia, so that places it in the late 1980s and certainly no later than 1991. At that time, I was a producer for what's now 891 Adelaide. I remember that my longtime technical producer, Gail Bartel, had popped out of the studio and I was at the control panel. My attention was focused on that control panel and, of course, the presenter. The presenter was probably Philip Satchell, a name that Adelaide people will remember as a much respected and veteran broadcaster. When suddenly, well, you know how you can sometimes sense that someone is behind you? Well, I had that sensation that day. I felt a presence. I turned my head and yes, someone was behind me. Someone tall, very tall. I looked up and up and up. All 194 centimetres. What's that? 6 foot, 4.5 inches. And yes, it was Gough Whitlam. It felt like he filled the room, not just physically, but with a presence. I don't want to say aura because that's all a bit rainbow crystal dolphin, but you knew that Gough Whitlam had arrived. Mr. Whitlam, good afternoon, I said. Carry on, comrade, don't let me interrupt you. He smiled and, look, he called everyone comrade, of course, and that was part of his shtick. And it sounds quaint now, but I could imagine how that sounded back in the 1960s and 70s. Anyway, I offered him a seat. I think I organised a coffee for him. And that's it. So that's not really much of a story. But I was a producer at that radio station for 7 years. And in the course of that, you meet all manner of people. And one of the things you learn is that it doesn't matter what job someone has. There are always nice people and assholes. There are always people who have had a good day and there are people who have had a bad day and want to take it out on the rest of the world. And Whitlam was, as people have said in the tributes over the last 36 hours, he was always generous of spirit and witty. I mean, a very, very smart man. And in that moment of interaction, you really did catch some of that. Now, I don't really have strong feelings about Whitlam one way or the other politically. Sure, he was a skillful parliamentarian. Sure, he changed Australia forever. And today, more than 40 years after he ended his time as Prime Minister in a thing called the dismissal, and kids, if you don't know about that, then look it up. It's a fascinating story, particularly if you're into the rough and tumble of constitutional law. But 40 years later, Whitlam still divides people. For Labor, he was, of course, the great victor, the great reformer. He introduced universal health care, free university education, paved roads and into the Napoleonic Wars, the steam engine, etc., etc., and everything else I mentioned. But for the Liberals, he represented something very, very scary. And even today, they push the line that the Whitlam government was an economic disaster. Greg Sheridan, who writes for The Australian, and I simply can't trust as a writer because I've seen him deliberately misrepresent political polling. He said today that in the 1970s, inflation was much worse in Australia than elsewhere. Except it wasn't. Someone else posted the chart today, and out of the OECD countries, Australia's inflation was just there in the middle. Stephen Kokoulis, who is the kook on Twitter, who writes about economics, he said, this is a wonderful line, this mantra of hopeless economic management that forever was associated with Whitlam just doesn't stick. But, you know, all of the Australian stories, which he refers to as the Tea Party faithful, wrote or were quoted as saying Whitlam was the worst prime minister. He was economically damaging. He set up the culture of entitlement, especially for health and university education, and he created the mentality of the dole bludger and so on. And these were based, he says, just on the perception that he allocated too much government money to healthcare, education, and the aged. But why does that matter? And in fact, when you actually look at the details of the economic record by the kind of numbers that the Tea Party mentality seems to think important, the Whitlam government actually did very well. In the financial year 1975 to 76, government spending as a proportion of GDP was 24.3%. Remember that, 24%. During the Fraser government, a Liberal government, that rose to 25.8%. And under the Hockey government, it's still 25.3%. When the Whitlam government left office, there was no net government debt, and the net debt was minus 0.4% of GDP. That is, the government actually had financial assets. The Fraser government pushed government debt up to 7.5% of GDP, and so on. As Kokoulis says, it's funny how facts can smash perceptions. What is big government? He asks. But Labor also has its myths about the Whitlam government. One of them is that Whitlam was somehow one of the first leaders to recognise communist China. I mean, this was during the Cold War, remember? Well, some of you don't remember the Cold War, but Red China, it was called. Now, Whitlam did go to China before Richard Nixon, the American president, did. There's about 3 years difference. 3 years later, Nixon went to China. But as Peter Brent tweeted today, he writes for The Australian, Australia was far from the first to recognise China. Let's actually do a list. Here's all of the nations that recognised China before Australia did, starting from when communist China became a thing in 1949. Here are those for 1949.
Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Bulgaria, and then there's those Romania, in the 1950s,
Hungary, India,
North Korea, and then the 1960s,
Poland, Indonesia,
and finally Albania, the 1970s,
Canada, Equatorial Guinea, Italy, Pakistan, France, Nigeria, Tanzania, Kuwait,
Central African Republic,
San Marino, Zambia, Austria, North Mauritania, Turkey, Cambodia, Belgium, Iraq, Peru, Morocco, Lebanon, Algeria, and Sudan, Senegal, Guinea, Iceland, Cyprus, Malta, Mexico, Argentina, Mauritius, Netherlands, Greece, Guyana, Togo, Japan, West Germany, Maldives, Madagascar, Luxembourg, Jamaica, Chad.
Never forget Chad. Australia wasn't so much of a leader, really, was it? Still, it was enough with a Prime Minister that kept saying comrade, with a Prime Minister who, in the first 6 weeks, changed more Australian legislation than in the entire period since the Second World War, and was friendlying up with China. That was enough to scare the United States. Indeed, if you have a look in Robert Lindsay's book, The Falcon and the Snowman, you'll see that the CIA was really quite worried about the prospect of a Labour government, really worried that China and indeed the Soviet Union could infiltrate the Australian government very, very easily. And we've seen some news stories about that over the last couple of years. Look, the final thing I want to say about Whitlam is that his entire election campaign was actually focused on the future. That was part of what made it so different. You heard the applause at the beginning of this podcast. Well, I just want to mention a few things from Whitlam's speech on that occasion. After his customary opening of Men and Women of Australia, he went straight into it.
The decision we will make for our country on the 2nd of December is a choice between the past and the future, between the habits and fears of the past and the demands and opportunities of the future. There are moments in history when the whole fate and future of nations can be decided by a single decision. For Australia, this is such a time.
Whitlam stressed that the entire world was on the brink of change.
The great powers are rethinking and remoulding their relationships and their obligations. Australia cannot stand still at such a time. We cannot afford to limp along with men whose attitudes are rooted in the slogans of the 1950s, the slogans of fear and hate. If we made such a mistake, we would make Australia a backwater in our region and a back number in history.
Men whose thoughts are stuck in the 1950s, eh? Men whose rhetoric is based on fear. Sound like any recent Prime Minister you know? Now, I won't go through all of Whitlam's speech. It was a staggering 14,000 words. That's like an hour and a half, probably more, at that stately pace. That's unimaginable today. But in 1972, they launched a policy in a speech, not in a brochure. But here's one key section, the announcement of Labor's health policy, which led to Australia's Medicare system.
Our universal health insurance scheme will give patients and doctors alike a wider freedom of choice and a freedom from needless worry that they just can't get under the Liberals' ramshackle scheme. Our plan for a single health insurance fund has been carefully costed to ensure that 4 out of 5 Australian families will pay less than they do under present arrangements, and 350,000 Australian families will pay nothing. I note that the latest complaint from the Australian Medical Association is that we've revised the details 3 times in the last 5 years. At least that's 2 times fewer than doctors have raised their fees.
Look, personally, I find the shift in rhetoric from Medicare being a universal health system to merely being a safety net to be well, really quite petty, small-minded thinking. And that's what the current government of Australia is doing. Australia is a wealthy nation, but it's stopped seeing itself as being able to provide for the entire nation. Instead, it will only extend a helping hand to those who have already been squeezed down to desperation, people who've already exhausted everything in their life and are just so miserable and so obviously in need of some sort of help that those that are slightly better off will finally groan and get up off their couches and be a member of a healthful and human community. I really don't like this selfish thing that Australia has become. No, look, Whitlam thought big, and that point was made by many of the writers and speakers this week, but none, I think, were as eloquent as Malcolm Turnbull, the Minister for Communications. Prime Minister Abbott did speak in favour of Whitlam, kind of. He still felt the need to insert a bit of party political point scoring and paying tribute to Sir Robert Menzies, who was Whitlam's Liberal predecessor. I mean, that's an improvement over the speech he made on the occasion of the death of Whitlam's wife, Margaret, a couple of years ago. But really, you know, the death of a prime minister should be about that prime minister, and Abbott somehow managed to make it about himself. Look, I know I'm turning Whitlam's death into a bit of a political dig too today, so I'm being a hypocrite, but at least I know I'm being a hypocrite and acknowledge that and can point to my own human weakness. Compared to Abbott, Turnbull spoke not for 6 minutes like Abbott did, but for an expansive 13 minutes. It's actually a beautiful, inspiring speech. I do recommend you listen to the whole thing. But here's one part about Whitlam thinking big.
Gough lived to a great age, and he had a great life. He was a big man with a big vision for a big country. He was an optimist. He was funny. He was witty. He always said, don't say I'm funny, say I'm witty. Well, he was witty and funny. And in all of that respect, we should celebrate that life. Now, we know Gough Whitlam's government was not, let's just say, unmarked by error. It was a controversial time. And I'll say a little bit about the influence of that on the Labor Party in a moment. But we have to remember that the economic arguments of those days have largely receded into history. I mean, the truth is that nobody on our side or the Labor side would agree with Gough Whitlam's economic agenda. We wouldn't agree with Billy McMahon's economic agenda. Life has moved on. But what is remembered is the myth of Gough, or as Gough would say, the mythos of Gough. What is that thread, that narrative that emerges from history out of the humdrum daily grind of political argument? What is it? And what it is, Madam Speaker, is an enormous optimism. And all of us admire that. Whether we voted for him in the 70s or our parents voted for him or whether we approved of what John Kerr did or not, all of that recedes. What people remember of Gough Whitlam is a bigness, a generosity, an enormous optimism and ambition for Australia. And that is something we can all subscribe to.
That bigness certainly came through in Whitlam's election campaign theme song, the famous It's Time. And I'm going to play that now in full because I want you to immerse yourself in the positivity of it for the full 2 minutes.
Yes, it's time. authorised M. Young, Ainslie Avenue, Canberra, for the Australian Labor Party.
That song hit the dull conservative backwater that was 1972 Australia like, look, I can't think of the metaphor, but today we'd say, what the actual fuck? I mean, in the chorus were TV megastars like Graham Kennedy and Burt Newton, the comedy geniuses of the period. Singers like Barry Crocker, Bobby Lim, Dawn Lake, Cole Joy, Jack Thompson, the actor, many others whose names, perhaps we've forgotten it 40 years later. Sure, it was contrived by an ad agency, but it carried with it such a genuine positivity because it was actually genuine. You can see it in the faces of the people if you watch the video. People did feel that it was time for a change. What would the equivalent be today, I wonder? I don't know that we have that. Are there any politicians in Australia today that could generate that sense of future thinking and positivity? I think not. And I think our country is in deep shit because of it. Now, that's where I'll leave my comments about Whitlam. But I want you to compare that with will.i.am, the American singer and now a designer of the future. Will.i.am has launched a thing called Pulse, P-U-L-S, which is yet another smart device that you stick on your wrist. It was launched only last week, I think, with a promotional video that really does need to be seen rather than just listened to get the full experience of the hilarity. But here's a taste.
They are leaders and there are followers. And followers follow leaders. And leaders are followers too. But they don't follow the crowd. They follow their gut. They follow their instinct. They dance to the beat of their own drum. They have the pulse because they follow their dream. They go against all odds. They're the oddballs, the bizarre, the weirdos, the freaks, the dreamers, the unique. They're hip-hop. They're punk rock. They're geek. They're chic. They are artistes.
Oh, God. Yeah, let's just skip to the end.
I am Will, and we are Fashionology.
So, in summary, we are all individuals, we are rebels. Here's a picture of a skateboarder, here's a picture of a woman with an edgy haircut. Repeat, repeat, repeat until the product is named. And if you're not paying attention to the words, it's easy to get sucked into the bullshit. So I figured you deserve to hear the words, just the words, read by my friend, the voice synthesizer.
There are leaders, and there are followers, and followers follow leaders, and leaders are followers too. But they don't follow the crowd, they follow their gut, they follow their instinct, they dance to the beat of their own drum, they have the pulse, because they follow their dream, they go against all odds, they are the oddballs, the bizarre, the widows, the freaks, the dreamers, they're unique, they are hip-hop, they are punk rock, they are geek, they are chic, they are artists, the black sheep, and a lot of people think they are cast from society. But the reality is, they are an army of strange, imaginative, wild and complex, beautiful people. And they are leaders. They are cultural tastemakers. They are trailblazers. These are the people that set the stage. These are the people that rock the stage. They are the ones who think of things you can't fathom, and imagine the things that have not been imagined. I am Will, and we are Fashionology.
Oh, just piss off, you stupid fucking tosser, Will.i.am. That's not the future. That's just, oh, we're cool, we're beautiful, we rock the stage, yeah, yeah, buy our fucking product. Oh, just piss off. Hello, I'm Stilgherrian. Welcome to The Edict.
Evening, Still. You're beautiful when you're angry.
This is Nicholas Fryer. I used to share a house with him some time ago. He knows too much. You should probably disregard everything he says, but he did make an effort to send in this comment, so we'll keep going.
I was intrigued by the comments from your caller last episode, which struck a chord in many ways. The problems of keeping our elected poo-bars in any sort of line once we elevate them to the high office to which they're certain they belong. They're obviously acute. But I'm struggling to love the suggestion of a general strike, even of massed sysadmins, principally from a practical point of view. I mean, I suspect that you could break a strike of tech gurus with tactical drops of coffee and donuts. And there's just nothing like the self-perceived disenfranchised class of angry people of the sort necessary to spark any sort of popular revolt. Because this is the real nub. Many good people are bitterly angry at elements of government policy. The thuggish incarceration of blameless human flotsam. Kids without their parents amongst them. The scaremongering, the ethno-religious scapegoating, murderous bombing of foreigners, the trashing of science while pantsing about pretending to be the last defenders of the Enlightenment. But all this is popular. These bigotries of vote winners. If you don't believe me, go and ask Bill Shorten if you can find the rock he's currently slithering under. There's no democratic solution to any of this. And a retreat from democracy is uncomfortable. Keep up the good fight.
Thank you, but Jesus, Nick, I believe I've said recently that the institutions of democracy are still here in Australia, that we just need to step up and operate the machine. I wish to make it clear that I dissociate myself from any suggestion that democracy itself has failed and that any sort of insurrection is required. I'm a dutiful citizen. I did proffer myself as a tsar last time. I do acknowledge that. But that's more for the swish office decor and the catering than anything else. Nevertheless, Nick, I do notice this morning that Scott Morrison, the Minister for Being a Cunt to Other People, has decided to issue some things called conclusive certificates. These are documents which, on his whim, on the grounds of something called the national interest, can kill off any possibility of someone making an asylum claim and any opportunity for them to appeal that decision. Now, note that this is not national security grounds. These people have already passed their national security checks. National interest. Morrison doesn't have to give any reason more specific than that. Think about it. One man can choose to erase someone's future. No reasons, no appeals. Now, whether this power is really, really legal is something that's going before the High Court of Australia in December, just a few weeks away. But Morrison isn't waiting to see whether it's legal for him to be doing this before crushing someone's future. He's going ahead. Just how big an arsehole would you have to be to do that? It makes Goetze look like a 12-year-old virgin. But you're right about the general strike, Nick. That's the depressing part. The system administrators have become fat and comfortable, figuratively. I mean, of course, I'm sure that physically all sysadmins are perfectly formed. Revolution might be an interesting intellectual exercise for them, but the only disruption they know about is how to make their wealthy, comfortable lives even more comfortable and pretty much screw everyone else. As long as they got their machines, you're right. Who cares? Thanks, Nick. Love your work too. Look, not all sysadmins are like this, of course, just the startup land libertarian man-children fucktards who seem to have decided that they alone represent not only the future of humanity, but its current existence and ideal forms. Which brings me nicely to my second comment of this episode.
Hi, Stilgarian, it's Justin Warren here. Long-time listener, first-time caller. My question is, what should the Australian IT industry be? You're on record of being very much anti-startup, that's capital S startup in the Silicon Valley style, of course, driven by greedy VCs out to cash in on a $1 billion lottery, the kind who throw millions of dollars of other people's money at harebrained schemes cooked up by marginal Stanford MBAs. You know the type. And all the get-rich-quick wannabes who flock there, hungering after the lifestyle of the lucky few who manage to find a bigger sucker to cash them out and have done nothing of consequence since. We have our share of Valley-style boosters here, of course. There are regular calls for special snowflake status for tech startups and regular iterations of the "if only we could have a Silicon Valley of our own" meme. seemingly ignorant of all the times people have previously tried that and failed. Rather than trying to set up an antipodean knockoff of one of the worst cultures in the modern world, couldn't we perhaps aim for something different? Something unique? Something distinctly, dare I say it, Australian? But what would that look like? Hopefully not some lazy Vegemite and Southern Cross flag cape stereotype, but something that takes advantage of our unique position on the globe. Given our remote location, well-educated populace and penchant for adopting every latest gizmo with unseemly gusto, you'd think that a high-technology industry like IT would be just the ticket, particularly now that the rest of the world appears to grow weary of the parts of WA and Queensland we like to dig up and sell them. Fibre optic cables place us milliseconds from Europe instead of months by bulk carrier, so it seems to me there's a wonderful opportunity here that's going begging. What do you think?
Well, thanks, Justin. I agree that we shouldn't try to replicate Silicon Valley. For a start, it's not possible. Stanford University has sat at the core of the valley for more than a century, and its entire purpose is producing technology creators. The Bay Area generally saw a unique collision of two kinds of freedom, two kinds of thought, the freedom-loving hippie counterculture and the freedom-loving libertarian followers of Ayn Rand. And those thoughts merged somehow over the last couple of generations. But more important than all of that has been the billions and billions of dollars from the US defense industry poured into the area, mostly during World War II and the Cold War, but certainly continuing afterwards. And some of that was, of course, a direct investment with the output of Stanford into the tech companies to make it richer. And the episode called The 9pm Caltrain talks a bit about that. Also, simply by creating an affluent society where successive generations of kids going through Stanford and the other places around the bay have been willing to take the risks because there is a familial safety net in case they screw it up. And combine that with a kind of, well, America is more forgiving of failure. There's that sense of you gave it a go, all right, you failed, dust yourself off and have another go. Whereas in Australia, failure sticks with you and you're branded a loser. Ooh, bottle top. Matzo's ginger beer from Broom is not too bad, but I'm also trying their mango beer tonight after a recommendation. Well, I won't be buying that again. It's why is Australia so willing to brand someone a loser? It's almost part of the tall poppy syndrome that if you try too hard, you're seen as a try-hard and your failure is your just comeuppance. And you're not meant to tackle things above your station. That's part of it, I think. I don't know how you change that. There's also, links to my columns on these issues on the website. I recommend that people read them. And I've said, yes, Australia needs to follow its own path. What that path is, I don't know. Justin mentioned wide open spaces there. Well, nuclear waste comes to mind. We've got to get rid of that shit somehow. Actually, the space industry. Australia was almost there with Woomera, which was built on Australia's dollar or pound as it was then to test the British nuclear program and then the British intercontinental ballistic missiles, except Britain cancelled that and bought Polaris from America instead and said, oh yeah, thanks for building Woomera, we won't be needing that now. Bits of it are there. We're doing flight testing for Japanese hypersonic aircraft and US missiles and so on, scientific work. And there's sometimes talk of spaceports on Cape York Peninsula. It always seems to get talked up and dies. Maybe we need to have a chat to Richard Branson. The kind of tourism market might work. Visit Australia, go into space, see the sharks, all of that. Australia also has an immense environmental knowledge. And, we don't think beyond infotech. Because one of the great tragedies is that when we talk about technology in phrases like the tech press, it always seems to mean information technology. And sure, that's been important over the last couple of decades to get us where we are, but it tends to overshadow other technologies such as genetics, nanotechnology, or biotech in general. Australians can collaborate anywhere with the internet. We already have institutions that know how to create new stuff. We just seem to lack the confidence and lack business leadership. Australian business leaders are relatively old. There's so many, you know, men, mostly men, nearly all men in their 70s on the boards of major companies. And they won't invest in things they don't understand, which is a sensible strategy. But these dinosaurs won't let go. That's not an answer, Justin, to your question, really. It's just more questions. But it is something that I'd like to hear more comments from people about. In fact, thank you both to Justin Warren and Nicholas Fryer for your comments this episode. I'd really love to get some more on this topic or any other. If you do want to contribute a comment to this podcast like that, you can either Skype Distilgerian or phone Sydney +61 2 8011 3733, or as these guys have done, recorded something at higher resolution rather than on the phone and sent it to me. I would love to hear from you. Elephant stamp time. This is the time where I give an elephant stamp of approval to people who've been exceptional in the category of thinking, and it's an all-Australian selection today. Bronwyn Bishop, first up, the Speaker of the House of Representatives in Canberra, for her work on the so-called burqa ban, this idea that anyone visiting Parliament who is wearing a face covering would have to sit in a separate glassed-off section of the House of Representatives so that they could watch democracy in action. Now, not only was this stupid from a security viewpoint, this moronic idea that people who have already been through a kind of security process involving metal detectors and so on would pose any sort of security threat. That's not the only silly part. I mean, the other silly part is the idea that Parliament would somehow fall into complete chaos if someone disrupted it. The really silly thing we discovered this week is that the whole thing was based on stupidity and rumour. Someone using the handle Media Manipulator had called into Radio 2UE in Sydney and talked about this kind of topic and suggested that there might be a demonstration underway, that people, women and men, wearing veils would come into Parliament House and then disrupt proceedings. Well, that's, you know, disrupt proceedings, big deal. You grab them and throw them out. But this rumour was on the radio. Somehow it then got to a Channel 9 camera crew. Presumably they heard it on the radio. They asked someone about it. Do you know about it? What are you doing about it? They didn't. So they went to the Department of Parliamentary Services that runs Parliament House, and they went to the Speaker, Bronwyn Bishop, and the President of the Senate as well, whose name entirely escapes me, but it's irrelevant to the story. And they did not actually get any security advice to say that they should do this. They invented this all on their own. So not only is it stupid from a security viewpoint, it's stupid from a process viewpoint. So an elephant stamp for Bronwyn Bishop, Speaker of the House of Representatives, and a second one today to Senator Jackie Lambie, the Tasmanian Senator for the Palmer United Party, for this question in Senate Estimates Committee today.
Do you have any information to suggest that Australia's enemies could attack our country or military using the virus?
This is Ebola she's talking about, and her question is essentially to the military.
For example, with suicide agents who are affected with the disease or have access to bodily fluids containing the disease? And what is your contingency plan to fight this?
Yes, it's one of those stupid movie plot terrorist scenarios which makes no sense in the real world. I mean, why would a terrorist go all the way from, say, Syria to Africa to get Ebola to then go back to Australia? And this whole elaborate get the disease and get the timing right and get bodily fluids on people. I mean, it's just much easier to bring some plastique into Australia and go there. So I must actually give points to the defence representative for keeping a straight face when giving his answer.
Well, I don't believe there is any evidence to suggest that that is a likely course of action. One of the things, Senator, that we have playing to our advantage is our geographic isolation. And the length of time that it takes simply to get to Australia, and the life cycle of the virus, it becomes very obvious relatively quickly how sick someone is. So I think the ability to inject someone into the country who is not showing symptoms would be quite difficult.
I'm just asking whether you have a contingency plan, because if you listen to one side of it, they can say this can take off to 10,000 a week. It can hit people by 10,000 a week. So I'm just wanting to know whether, you know, this can be passed through ticks, fleas. You know, is there a contingency plan through the Defence Force to tackle the Ebola issue? That's what I want to know. Are your men and women protected?
Senator, our men and women are as protected as anyone else in the country is. The response to that hypothetical situation would be the response to any outbreak of Ebola in Australia. Our health system has its preparations ready for the virus appearing in the country.
Thank you, Senator Jackie Lambie. Elephant stamp for you. A big thank you to all the supporters who make this podcast possible. Today, a big shout out to Crispin Harris, who not only is a paying subscriber to this little establishment, but the other week he funded my little tour of Rooty Hill in Sydney's West, where we chatted about many things, and I learnt quite a bit about Rooty Hill. I did not, as it happened, decide to record anything on that day. I've decided that was a reconnaissance mission, and I'll come back and do something with Rooty Hill properly when I have time to explore it and have something meaningful to say, a little bit like with my visit down to the Shire. I didn't want to kind of just be a fly-in, fly-out instant expert on the western suburbs of Sydney. So that's coming up soon. Thank you, Crispin, for your support. If you would like to support this podcast financially, you can go to the Skank Media website at skank.com.au/subscribe to set yourself up for a monthly contribution, or /tip if you want to make a one-off contribution. And it would be really good if we could get that little line on the chart going up and to the right, as opposed to just going to the right over time. Also, a quick apology to Rachel Olding of the Sydney Morning Herald. I accidentally mispronounced your name as Oldling last time. That's because I didn't have my right glasses on, and I could see too many letters in your name. That's all a bit sad. Well, that's it for the edict for now. I don't actually have an edict to say at the end of this episode, because I'm running short of time. We need to get this produced and online, but if you want to leave an audio comment, Skype to Stilgerian or phone Sydney +61 280113733 and send me your thoughts. Even better than your thoughts, send your money. There will be one more episode before the end of October. I'm Stilgerian. See you then.
The 9 p.m. Edict is a Skank Media production. Sorry.